Namaste. Good morning to everyone. We'll take up some questions that have come in. I would like to thank those of you who send your questions because they benefit everyone when we speak about them, understand them. They benefit me as well. And the teaching gets uncovered, so to speak, through these questions pertaining to daily living. My only request is to not send questions on Facebook because it's not possible for us to track them there, but to write to the website. I'd also like to add that after the satsang is over, if you all feel like interacting with each other, speaking to someone in particular, you are welcome to, because it's kept open. And it's been a long time since I thanked the volunteers who make these live recordings possible, Sangeeta, Divya, and everyone else who is contributing in some way to this, enabling it to spread even further. I am struggling a lot with one issue I wonder if you can help with. I seem to feel quite well and contented until I have to make a big life decision. Then I get into a big struggle to make. I pray, meditate, ask for signs, journal, talk it through with trusted friends, but seem to get more and more confused. I want to know and do God's will and to learn the lessons I'm being given. But I just find it impossible to decide clearly either way. I don't know what the lesson is or what I'm being asked to do. And then I start judging myself and affecting people with my decision. This situation is clearly crazy, and I don't know how to do it differently. The last sentence has the answer in it. I'm very scared to get it wrong. This is a very beautiful question because many of us are not sure about taking the right decision for the big things in life. Firstly, indecision is a quality in one's nature. Some people take decisions easily, some are unable to take decisions easily. They ponder over it, think about it, get more confused sometimes, and so on and so forth. So the first step is to accept that in the case of this body-mind organism, indecision happens. Frustration may arise because, as she says, it can affect others. But the answer is there. Why am I indecisive? Because I am scared to get it wrong. The fear of the me. So what happens? This fear of getting it wrong starts dropping away. Because now we know there's no such thing as taking a wrong decision. A decision has to be taken. The results are not in my control. I cannot control the flow of life. I do my best in a given situation. Thereafter, it is God's will. So this trust in the process of life and living needs to come in, which is missing. And whatever the outcome of the decision, it will be a learning for me. If it goes my way, pleasure may arise, but no pride or arrogance, because it was not my doing. And pain may arise, but no guilt or shame, because it was not my doing. So if this understanding goes deep, it actually can liberate one from this burden of taking right and wrong decisions. Because what happens if I take a wrong decision, then I blame myself, I condemn myself. You should not have made this decision. Because of this, this has happened, which the ego loves. But when you know deep down that you truly cannot take a right or wrong decision, it is just that your decision is a part of the flow of life, part of the totality of what is meant to happen, and you are just a piece of the puzzle. This claim the ego makes on decisions, that starts dropping away. And one starts living the life courageous. Not my will, O Lord, but thine be done. And so, as I have mentioned before, in the question itself, in many questions that we discuss, the answers are to be found. It is the cloak of the ego which wraps itself in doership. That cloak has to drop away. And so indeed, as I said, in this question, I want to know and do God's will. God's will is happening in any case. Who is this one who wants to know God's will? That is the ego, which considers itself as split, apart, separated from God, and now wants to know what God's will is. I don't know what the lesson is. The lesson is the consequence of the decision and knowing that it could not have been any other way. So truly, while it may be that one's nature is to be indecisive, with the light of understanding, the good fortune that one comes across some wisdom teachings, these situations in life which are perplexing tend to get answered. I have a book here which I want to address one point later, but in light in relation to this, it struck me. Let me see if I can find it. A very beautiful thing Maharaj has said. Basically, he says that consciousness drags you by the ear to such teachings. He was referring to his place, his attic in Khetwadi. Consciousness drags you here because it wants to hear about itself. So beautiful. Another beautiful question which many people can relate to. I find that although I can see the entire structure of mind and personality with meditation, I am not able to discern myself as consciousness. I still have the feeling that I am a jiva meditating. Everything is visible, but the covering over witnessing itself is strong. This is the first part which I would like to address. I find that although I can see the entire structure of mind and personality with meditation, I am not able to discern myself as consciousness. There is no need to discern of yourself as consciousness, because consciousness is what you are. If you just sit right now with your eyes closed, you are being. The pure awareness of being. It does not have to be discerned, because that is your very nature. Discerning it becomes an intellectual process. This beingness cannot go anywhere. So the mind is trying to wrap itself around this teaching and concepts where there is no need to. That is what the mind specializes in doing, creating trouble. And it's much, much more simpler than the mind can imagine. I still have the feeling that I am a jiva meditating. Who has the feeling? It is the ego that has the feeling that the ego is meditating. When the ego feels I am doing the meditation. If right now one just sits in a state of receptivity to what is, the presence of being, there is nothing more required. It is this claim, this false claim, that I am the one who is sitting and meditating. That is the troublemaker. Sitting is happening, meditating is happening. As simple as that. Thoughts may arise, and when thoughts get extended in the duration of time as involvement, that is when the me has stepped in. What all do I have to do today? I better remember. This one said this to me, that one said that to me. When those thought processes are not being engaged in, one is back to witnessing. Again, simple. I feel unconsciously being sucked into the tides of mind always during activities. Conscious being is felt only once in a while. This is everybody's story. When there is work, for example, one is engaged in work. There's no question of thinking, oh, I'm consciousness while I'm working. If one is in the working mind mode, if the thinking mind takes over by delving into the dead past or an imaginary future full of regrets and full of expectations and so on, that is now the ego with its sense of doership which is operating. But if during the day I find that I'm engaged in my work, somebody gives me a phone call, there's no question of remembering one's being all the time. One is already that. So this covering, this layer is of this engaged thinking mind. Nothing more than that. The ego is trying to become what it already is. That is the problem with the ego. You see? Because it feels I can do it. I can become what I already am. That am really doesn't need the ego's help. With the cessation of the thinking mind of the ego that is based on doership, conscious being is there. That conscious being is sometimes in the working mind mode, and when there's no work happening, it is just being or witnessing, you could say. That is the flow of life. Simple and straightforward. Not this need to analyze each and everything away, which is how the mind is made. I feel my being to be enveloped by a layer of unconscious thoughts, memories, and desires. Discrimination of this to be unreal seems light in intensity. Hence, this unconscious layer has got dictatorship over life. It appears this way, but it's not really true, because the mere fact that these questions are arising and this is known means there's an awareness of what is happening. So it may appear that there's a lot of unconscious activity for many of us. Many of us operate on knee-jerk reactions, for example, hardwired conditioning, unconscious activity, you could say. But you see, the beauty of the spiritual journey is when one step is taken, which is just the step of being aware of these patterns, knowing this is how the mind is, being aware that there is a lot of unconscious activity. What a blessing that is. Why not look at it that way? Because many of us live our lives in total unawareness. So one needs to be grateful to the divine that this much awareness you have brought in, and it is that awareness which takes one home. So what the ego is trying to do is speed up the process. No, I should not have so much unconscious activity. I should not this, I should not that. I should be more still. That is the dialogue which is the mischief maker. But if something has brought to one's awareness all these points, why not trust that something? As I keep saying what Rameshji would say, if God has brought you so far, why do you think he will drop you here? So let not this process be a punishment. Let it be one of wonder, gratitude, awe, discovery, adventure, knowing that what is destined to happen. If my peace is destined to happen, no power on earth, including my own self, can not make it happen. Eckhart Tolle had said, leave life alone, let it be. And I would say, more so for your spiritual journey, leave it alone, let it be. Don't overanalyze, don't dissect, don't get wrapped in trying to understand this whole thing too much, if you can help it, of course. Some of us are not programmed that way. We get entangled in everything. let it be. What can help me overcome this layer? Will external renunciation help? Frankly, external renunciation is inconsequential. If we renounce this claim and this ownership of people doing things and we doing things, that is the only renunciation needed. When we free people from judgments, blame, condemnation, hatred, malice, and so on and so forth, that is the true renouncing. Renounce the need to renounce. Renounce all the garbage that has been accumulated in the mind through years and years of conditioning. I did this and he or she did that. In any case, everything is renounced in deep sleep. Please answer. This is the next question. I have lost faith in Shirdi Sai Baba and I want to regain it. But got to know I need to accept totally whatever is happening is God's will. And this acceptance is not coming. If this acceptance is not coming, accept it. But I have lost faith in Shirdi Sai Baba. Why? Please ask yourself that. Did he make you a promise that he didn't fulfill? Or did you have an expectation that he would give you something and you didn't get it? I have lost faith in Shirdi Sai Baba. What does your faith depend upon? Please look at that. Or is it a total unconditional faith that whatever happens in my life is Baba's will, who is a representation of the Absolute, of God, consciousness? He knows best. If we make a claim on any master, we assume he doesn't know. If he is all-pervading, all-knowing, and so on, is there a need to tell anything? So please look deeply at what was the foundation of your faith, and perhaps you may see that it is there that the correction needs to happen. Coincidentally, I was rereading this Maharaj booklet where he says, he talks about his disciple Jean Dunn. And he tells someone that with her faith and her love for the Guru, which is Maharaj, the gods will come and do pranams to her. You see, that faith does not depend on anything. That is an unconditional surrender. Most of us have faith when we get what we want and things go our way. And when they don't, we lose faith. What kind of a faith is that? If surrender is there, acceptance will come and vice versa. So kindly help me get either of it. There is no vice versa. You see, this is a commonly asked point. What is the difference between acceptance and surrender? Now, let's say I accept this concept that everything is God's will. And why do I accept it? Because it makes sense, it has been my experience, and so on. And I accept at some level, nobody is the doer of their actions, because even that does make sense. May not be all the time, maybe sometimes. So the acceptance may be there, but there is still suffering. I still blame people, I still blame myself, although I accept it. Now, acceptance sometimes can be perceived as an intellectual acceptance. Why? Because it is not percolating into daily living. But that is not true, you see, because one option would have been you reject the concepts. I don't believe that everything is God's will. I don't believe that no one is the doer of their actions. Finished. But if the acceptance is there, somewhere you have been touched. And let's call that somewhere the heart. Something has touched you. But the mind is still grappling with it. Now, once one sees through this prism of everything being God's will, nobody doing anything, what happens is surrender, total acceptance, not surrender in the sense of I give up. I'm not referring to that surrender of fatalism. That is another story. But the difference between acceptance and surrender is that the mind no longer plays a role in the surrender. So surrender is total. Acceptance, a bit here, a bit there. But when one finds that one is now at peace with what is, then one knows one is surrendered to God's will. That is the difference. So one cannot go back from surrender to acceptance. If one looks at it in this way, the journey is from acceptance to surrender, which is nothing but a total acceptance. Now, for example, in my case, when I went to visit my teacher and he said, everything is God's will, nobody does anything, it made so much sense to me. It seemed so obvious to me when the way he explained it, that I realized later that there was total surrender from the start. I didn't have to go through this process of questioning, of trying to understand, making sense of it. It is later that I realized that that is called surrender. And I saw it operating in life, in relationships with people and with circumstances in life. So that is an important point. This distinction between acceptance and surrender. I would like to read out something. I was asked in an interview recently about the difference between the absolute and consciousness, or consciousness and prior to consciousness. And I had mentioned in that interview that that can only be known in consciousness. And so the question arose that if it is prior to consciousness, why is it said, why are you saying that it can be known only in consciousness? And I said, because awareness is unaware of itself as awareness, but aware of itself as I am. So I'd like to read this out for those who are following Nisargadatta Maharaj's teachings. I would suggest if you can read this small booklet. Someone told me it's no longer available. Jean Dunn Journals. It's her diary actually, and has many deep insights. You'll enjoy it if you like reading Maharaj's teaching. So the same thing, I was so happy I found this, you know, maybe it will give you some more clarity. It's a dialogue between Jean Dunn and Maharaj. Maharaj says, remain quiet in the consciousness. The one who understands the quality of this beingness transcends it and is no more affected by birth or death. The consciousness knows itself through the aid of the body. So Jean Dunn asks, without it, what remains? Maharaj, the absolute state, the stable absolute state out of which the five elements take shape or form, where the movement is frozen but the potential is there, that is Parabrahman. There is no movement. When out of that the movement begins, that is Saguna Brahman, the manifestation. So Jean Dunn asks, but there is nothing conscious about it. Maharaj, the absolute does not know itself. Without the food essence body, consciousness does not know itself. Nobody knows himself without the food essence body. Jean Dunn. Let's say Maharaj is in the absolute state. Then he is not aware of himself. Maharaj, I know that state forever. Jean Dunn. But you just said it didn't know itself. Maharaj, if that state alone prevails, it will not know itself. But when this body and beingness is available, it is known through these. And finally, Jean Dunn, but when the body disappears, then Maharaj, no knowing. So you see, this whole discussion is taking place in consciousness. So for us to say that if it's prior to consciousness, then why does it need the body? That is how the mind structures the sequence of events. But it is awareness, unaware of itself as awareness. As Rameshji would say, God, the source, potential energy, not dead matter, potential, throbbing potential energy, activized and manifestation happened as a reflection within consciousness, a reflection of the source within itself, not apart from itself. So this might have sounded a bit abstract for some of y'all, but those who have been familiar with Maharaj's teachings, and I had received a couple of mails and messages to clarify this point in the interview. This is the clarification which I think will perhaps be of satisfaction. So now I would request if anyone wants to ask something or share something, they can put up their hands and we will address them. What a beautiful journey this is. Yes, Vandana.
Hello, Gautam.
Hello.
Last time I was going to ask you the same question, but I got disconnected. So I only know the, being a doctor, know the anatomic heart. What is meant by spiritual heart?
Vandana, now That can also get very conceptual, but I like to keep it very simple. You see, the heart is not, the heart being referred to in these teachings is not based on a location. It is the heart of awareness. It is awareness, truth, consciousness means the heart of the matter, which means not the mind. So when we say take the teaching to heart, it means let it permeate your being, not letting it be just at an intellectual level. And how would you know that it permeates your being? When you find that in daily living, you are more at peace with what happens, with your relationships, and so on and so forth. So that is what I would call the spiritual heart. But as a phenomenon, as Ramana Maharshi said, the spiritual heart is the heart which is on the right side of the chest. It is not a physical heart. It is, let's say, one's connection with the source, with the divine. And for those who are, so to speak, more advanced on the path, some of them have that experience of the spiritual heart. But truly, living from the heart is what happens when these teachings are imbibed. If you do find that your association with people and the way you think about them has changed compared with before the teaching, if you do find your relationship with the events in your life has changed compared with earlier, the way you view life and what happens, then the teachings have gone to the heart.
Is it synonymous with developing compassion?
That would be a natural outcome of the teaching going to the heart. Mm-hmm. That would be a truly a natural outcome. And in fact, if that happens, then you really know that the teaching has gone to the heart. You cannot develop compassion and then the teaching goes to the heart. The compassion arises because, Vandana, truly, when you have this sense of, you know, knowing that we are all in this together, we've all come to fight our own battles, we've been shaped by conditioning beyond our control, and we all have our own worldview, compassion is bound to arise. You, when you see that people cannot help being themselves, including you, compassion is bound to arise. Truly, take someone in your life who pushes your buttons, and when you really see that, my God, this person is just playing their script based on their conditioning, how they were treated, where they grew up, which school they went to, compassion will arise for that person. Maybe even a prayer will arise, you see. That may not have happened before. Then you know you've taken the teaching to the heart.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Ramanathan.
Namaste, Gautam.
Namaste.
Actually, this is not a question, actually. It's in response to what Ms. Vandana asked for. As you rightly said, this also can be shared, right? Can also share. So what I found is when I do japa, or as Bhagavan has taught, vichara, right? Bhagavan always said the heart is on the right. It's not the location, as you actually said. It's not the location. The right side, right part of the heart starts throbbing. And you want that more of that experience that I have always sought for. And when I seek that experience, it goes away. The throbbing starts when I do vichara. And Bhagavan always said, because that's the place where all the nerves are starting, and the consciousness which is spread into the body starts withdrawing itself to the brain, and from that brain it sinks back into the heart, right, into the truth or the consciousness. So that's my understanding of what, for example, Bhagavan's teachings are, or what Sadhu Om has given an explanatory book, The Path of Sri Ramana, Part 1.
Yes, and that's absolutely right, and that's beautifully expressed. I can't hear you suddenly.
Oh, it was muted. Sorry, it was only a sharing.
Definitely. Yes, yes, no, that's beautiful. Thank you. And it makes total sense and it's absolutely clear. Where do you live? I've forgotten.
I'm based out of Bangalore.
Bangalore, okay. And you visit, do you visit Thiruvannamalai often?
Once in a year I go there. In God's grace, I go there.
Once in a year you go there.
It's close by actually.
It's about 6 hours, right?
It's close by.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you, Ramanathan. Would anyone else like to ask something? I'm quite biased to making trips to Ramana Ashram and Thiruvannamalai. And for those who are interested in this journey of self-investigation, inquiry, if you are drawn to it in any way, then it would only be of benefit, may not be conscious benefit, because the mind really doesn't know what's really impacting the heart and what isn't. But rest assured that whatever is meant to happen for one in such an environment with the holy mountain Arunachala, which is a manifestation of Shiva, it will happen. So if the idea appeals to you, then, and when things open up, then do make a trip there. And if you find, if anyone on this journey finds that they are becoming quieter. In fact, I didn't take a printout of this question, but someone asked this, that they find that they're becoming quieter and perhaps more serious in life. You see, the quieter being, becoming quieter will happen because the thinking mind is dying down. The chattering mind, as within, so without. Chatter, 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 chatter. When the chattering of the thinking mind dies down, this need to talk, to express opinions on everything, this need to be validated, this need to judge, and so on, starts dropping away. So do not be surprised if you find that you are becoming quieter. It could be something as simple as, let's say you are at a lunch table with friends or family and someone has seen a movie and expressed how great it is and you felt it wasn't that great and you expressed yourself and it offended the other person. All these things happen. These mundane things come up. But what happens is there's no longer any need to go on engaging. You accept that person said what they did, I said what I did, it's finished. The engagement in this drama stops, so you become quieter. But this part of life becoming more serious needs to be looked at. Because it could sound that seriousness means life is a burden. It's not no laughing matter. It is for many people, of course, where there's a lot of suffering. But rather than using the word serious, I would say that it makes life quieter and lighter. Life becomes lighter. So if you feel you become serious, take a look at what you mean by the word serious. Does it mean a sense of heaviness? If so, why is that there? Who is this me who feels that heaviness? And so on and so forth. In fact, prior to this understanding, life is more serious. And after this, if it impacts one, life becomes lighter. Light. Lighter means there's light. There's light of understanding, of consciousness. If consciousness drags you by the ear to ear itself, there's no option but for life to be lighter. Enlightened living, light. The light of understanding. I received this question, which I think is a bit intricate, but just to touch upon it lightly, this is someone who says that some sort of energy is in my body almost always, and it seems to descend into me through the top of my head. This energy helps me but harms me more. Due to this, I am not living in what you call normal consciousness. This is very sad if this is what is happening, because usually it is the descending energy which is more beneficial than if the energy rises uncontrolled from below, the ascending energy. So that this has happened is sad. And there's a mixed bag here. A part of my mind is always and automatically observing everything, which is a good thing. Two, I can't hang on to any opinions. Not bad. Everything is contradicted. I am confused. I experience both sides of everything, almost one after another. I experience fears of all kinds. Desires and fears automatically manifest, like for most of us. I experience visions, voices, premonitions, insights, awareness. The body is cool, skin and hair very soft, almost silky, but there is no sense of smell. I hear buzzing sound in my ears like the sounds of crickets or bees. I experience constant recurrence as well as healing of childhood illnesses. Life is incredibly hard. It sounds like what has been given in terms of the descending energy has become a blessing as well as a curse. The wires have got crossed, so to speak. So there's not much I can answer about this, because I need to know more information. When did it begin? What happened? And so on and so forth. But it is, wherever this person is, the need for guidance is required. In fact, I would suggest a one-to-one guidance, preferably with someone you can meet and be with, if that is possible, because that will be of tremendous help. There is always hope when you are on the spiritual path, on the journey. The answers will come. But in this case, it is, I feel, better if you develop some communication with someone who you can be in direct contact with. A lot of the phenomena expressed here happen when certain faculties open up. But at the same time, whatever is in the unconscious, all the fears residing in the unconscious, in the subconscious, can come up. And so when the energy is not really integrated, it can exaggerate these fears, which is what has happened. So it is becoming this push and pull. Result is no peace of mind. And let it be clear that the teaching of Advaita, you see, everything is energy. So the path of knowledge, Jnana Yoga, is also energy. For example, if you are finding yourself to be more at peace with these teachings, it is because it has impacted your energy. The blocks which were there, caused by judgments, hatred for others, and blame and so on, those blocks have either been chiseled away with this teaching or have been shattered, depending on a case-to-case basis. So what is happening? More peace means clearer energy. Less conflict in life means more peace, means your energy is less conflicting. And that is why this measure of peace of mind in daily living, which seems so simple that it's too simple to be of any importance, is actually the most beautiful measure to know how your energy is vibrating. And if you find that people are telling you, oh, you've become more peaceful, I like being with you, or you find people coming up to you and asking you questions, looking up to you for some suggestions and so on, then you know that it has had a direct impact on the energy. All right, maybe we can end with a 5-minute meditation or silent sitting. I'll just change the view so I can see all of you. What you see is what is within you. For example, if you see someone who is at peace, you yourself have to know what that feeling of peace is to know someone else is at peace. So that is already within you. If we sit together and just abide in being, there is no difference between you, me, or anyone else sitting with us right now. Because that being is only being. But if we sit as individuals with me and my story, then we are not sitting together. But if we just sit and be, then there cannot be any separation between us. Now when I speak, isn't my voice arising in your own consciousness? If it was arising outside your consciousness, you could not hear me speak. So if my voice is arising within your own consciousness, am I apart from you? The person you like is appearing within your consciousness, and the person you don't like is also appearing within your consciousness. Whatever arises in your consciousness has already been met by you. In the day, whatever you encounter is meant for you and been met by you. It is the mind which struggles with what is happening and says, I like this and I don't like that, and so on and so forth and so forth. To just have this awareness that whatever arises is arising in consciousness is itself meditation. Thank you.